Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schweiger and Matt Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us an awesome 5-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk more about cybersecurity. Each episode will focus on a specific topic of interest to the community. Today, we're going to be talking about an article about the future of InfoSec. We think this is going to be a two-parter, but we're not exactly sure where the split will be. So be prepared for an abrupt stop at the end of the first part and an awkward start at the beginning of the second part.
And as usual, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not express the views or opinions of our employers.
Next, then, we can talk about insurance, which I think we have a lot of agreement here because we've been talking about insurance for quite a while. And I will tell you once again that I have never thought that insurance would be one of my favorite topics for information security. And yet here we are again. But insurance will be a major player in information security, he believes. And he believes that most of the improvements in InfoSec will come from insurance companies forcing their clients to improve. Now, this is something we have discussed several times. And he mentions parallels here in cars and houses, our health insurance offering perks for people who work out, which I generally refuse because I don't want them to have that information. And he discusses how insurance companies are going to want visibility into the networks, just like the governments, and just like how they want to see into your car or your health data. They want to, you know, connect to your Garmin or whatever and see how much are you walking, what's your pulse rate like, et cetera. They want to get the black box into your car. They want to watch, you know, how fast are you going, et cetera. And
I think they're already partially doing this, you know, with the parallel with the health thing, because I've worked for a couple of different companies before where they will give you a discount on your health insurance if you have a physical every year or for that year, they'll give you a discount. Whereas an insurance company might say, well, you need to have a pen test or a SOC 2 completed in order to be covered or to get a discount, maybe. So this is already kind of starting down this path like he's talking about.
Yeah, we talked a couple of months ago about how after all the ransomware going on, the health and the insurance companies were really starting to crack down. Their questionnaires before they would cover you were in a lot more detail. They wanted to see a lot more evidence beforehand. This is just a natural continuation.
Yeah, and I think eventually, you know, you're talking about the black box on cars, and we've mentioned this before, that they're going to want a black box in their network. And I think the black box is going to be more, I think it would be more beneficial for it to be like an attack simulation type platform than just a simple network monitor of some kind.
I don't know that just a black box would work if it was an attack simulation, because it wouldn't be just a black box. It'd also be tied into your, you know, single network brain / Splunk or whatever. But I think they'd want both. I think they'd want to be tied into your brain and be running the attack sim. I don't think it'd be as simple as just putting a black box on the network. I think they'd want a full integration.
Right. I agree. That's what I'm saying. I think it would be more like attack simulation and less like a black box is what I mean.
Oh, I see.
And maybe I didn't say that well. Because attack simulation requires now, in order to really work well, to be tied into your SIM, which is really that brain that you're talking about in this future instance. I think one of the things that might be challenging for this, that the insurance companies would probably have to acquiesce to or have some kind of agreement with on the company, is, you know, attack simulation platform on the network as a black box type scenario. I would be, as a company, I'd be leery about fully understanding exactly what that attack simulation system is doing and what information it's feeding back to the insurance company. Because I think one of the things that we may have touched on before is the vulnerability that interconnected third parties have for organizations. So imagine that the insurance company throws this attack simulation platform on your network as it's collecting all this information, it's pulling all this information from your giant brain or whatever, and they get compromised, then that attacker may have access to all that rich detail about your organization as well.
Well, and depending on that black box and its abilities, I mean, if it's an attack simulation black box, it may have the ability to reach out and touch something. You know, it may have, you know, RDP or other services, SSH services enabled, because that may be the way that it's simulating those attacks. And it may be whitelisted everywhere in the network, because generally speaking, I was just talking with somebody about one of these attack simulation tools, and they were saying, no, well, you've got to whitelist our external IP address so that we can download the malicious scripts that your firewall blocked so that we can run them and see if you're AV catches them. I was like, well, the firewall blocked them from being downloaded. Isn't that good enough? And they're like, oh no, we don't check those logs. So we need it to run on the host because we're only looking at the EDR/AV logs. So depending on how the black box is set up, like if you break into the insurer, I mean, this is like breaking into, what was that like admin company last year that they broke into? And then they broke into like 50 other companies through them.
Oh, the MSS that was broken into?
Yeah, like an MSS. Yeah, this would be like breaking into an MSS. All of a sudden the insurance companies are going to have giant targets on their backs.
Right. And hopefully they're drinking their own Kool-Aid.
Oh my God. You know what? That's exactly what's going to happen, right? They're going to require everybody else to have great security and they're going to have terrible security. And then, that's going to be
a nightmare.
Yep.
Yeah. It's like the man, what the heck is the name of that Italian company that had the malware for hire?
We're terrible at remembering things right now.
Hacking team. Who had absolutely atrocious, they had all this malware for hire and was breaking and doing all this attack stuff. And yet their own corporate security was absolutely terrible and had all their stuff stolen and published on the internet.
Yeah. Hacking team. Ridiculous.
But he also suggests that since insurance companies will have visibility into tools, they will have the most success in producing like Gartner type reports for InfoSec tools to rate tools. And I think, you know, this is, you know, and he really references to the Michelin star guide for restaurants. And I think this is a little bit more nuanced and harder to do than that. Cause really when you're looking at the Michelin star guide, you don't look back in the kitchen and you're looking at the output from the kitchen, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas when you're talking about security tools, depending on how they function, how they're configured, will determine how well they work, right?
Yeah. And frankly, I don't think that they're going to be as in-depth as the Michelin guide either. I think it's going to be more about broad comparisons. Like we talked about this before, where it'll be, you know, people that have this EDR tool implemented see a 20% decrease in breaches as compared to people who have this tool completed. I don't think they're going to be doing like in-depth Michelin reviews and, you know, awarding stars necessarily.
Well, it might be helpful if they, because what I would think, they might be able to publish statistics like that, but that's like almost like the stock market saying that, you know, past gains are not evidence of future gains. So they can say that, you know, 80% of the companies that have this tool installed have fewer breaches or whatever. But if they're able to say that this particular type of security tool has the best default configurations and is most likely going to lead to fewer negative outcomes for you, then that would get a higher rating than one that has bad default configurations. So if you deploy it and are not as good in your deployment, at least you'll be starting at a higher point than if you chose a different product.
You know, there was actually one of the latest MITRE attack simulations and tool evaluations. I don't remember what section of MITRE does it, but they just did something like that where they tested a tool. They tested a bunch of tools against an adversary emulation where they allowed them to tune the tool. And then they also tested it against a untuned default install, which I thought was super interesting. Because there's a, I'm not going to mention which sandbox it is, but I recently had a friend of mine or a coworker of mine tell me that such and such sandbox he'd heard was really the best sandbox, but it required a lot of tuning and upkeep. And I'm like, well, I'm not interested in it then. Like, I don't want to buy something that requires a ton of extra work to make it work well. Yeah. I want to buy something that works well out of the box. And then if we have time, we can make it really hum.
Right. But depends on, you know, how much better that is and whether you can dedicate a resource to it. You know,
yeah, because you almost never can. You can, it's for some reason, for every company I've worked for, they're like, we'll buy this tool, and they buy it and they never dedicate the time to really make it work well.
Right. Because nobody has it. I mean, even large companies generally cannot dedicate a person to a tool like that, with the exception being Splunk. I mean, some people have, you know, dozens, some companies have dozens and dozens of people dedicated just to Splunk itself. But in the security space, it's not practical. But I think, you know, as far as this rating thing goes, I think where the insurance companies could help out is they could say, you know, you get this base rating on the tool, right? It says that this tool is a 7.6 based on Stiefel configurations. But then they could say, well, this is also modified based on your environment to say that, you know, you have this tool deployed, the administrator assigned to the tool is certified on it, 90% of your endpoints have coverage on it, you know, and different criteria like that to say, well, if you meet these things, then you can say that, well, your rating is probably going to be an 8, so your insurance level is this, and we're going to charge you X, or something like that. Might be kind of a qualifying thing where the company could even know, or if all the potential customers of the insurance company may be able to know that information up front to get an idea about the level of effort they would need in order to decrease their spend on their insurance if they know that this is what the insurance company is looking for. But of course,
yeah,
that may be something the insurance company is not going to want to publish either, because that's part of their secret sauce. I don't know.
Oh, but, and that'd be super useful too, again, where you can have that special tool that maybe if you've got the secret sauce to make it work, the extra, and then you can prove it and then they can drop your rate based on that. But I think I actually very much prefer them giving a floating rate based on the quality of your defense, as opposed to just saying like, yes or no, we will cover you or not.
Right.
Because a yes or no, we will cover you or not just encourages the company to be like, all right, well, we're going to do exactly as much as we need to get covered. And then boom, we're done.
Right. Or hide stuff.
Or hide. Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. And to your point, I think what part of that thing could be that, and if the insurance company has the statistics to back it up, they might be able to say that, you know, regardless of the maybe the tool, the particular tool you choose is something that, you know, is another modifier to your base core, but your base core might be what types of capabilities do you have deployed? Because we find that companies that have an EDR deployed, an IDS deployed, and a proxy deployed, these companies are, you know, 30% less likely to suffer a breach or something like that. So you could say, okay, well, that's a base core off top because you have these technologies deployed that then gets modified by which technology deployed. And gets modified again based on the capabilities or the modifications that you've made that technology, like we were talking about. You have an admin, you have 90% coverage, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So you have like three layers of determination to say, this is how we're going to rate you. You know, what's your stack look like? What have you put in your stack? And how well is your stack configured?
Yeah.
And then all this can be done with automation, which is the next section.
Yeah. Well, he sees that you're going to be able to replicate some level 2 or 3 analyst functions. He sees the greatest benefit is going to be from essentially having hundreds or thousands of level 1 analysts, as opposed to completely getting rid of the 2s and 3s. Now, I'm hoping this is correct, where he talks about more standardization is going to equal more logging, which is going to equal more data and more alerts. I don't know if I believe in the more standardization thing. I feel like people have been trying to do standards forever and failing at it, but maybe I spend too much time with my head in the SIM, and because I've been working on SIM standardization for a decade and it has not improved. But
yeah, I mean, you would like to think that the common information model, once that was established, that would have been, you know, good enough, you know, but the problem is that it's not being adhered to. Unfortunately, you know, these kind of logging standards are not like USB, where, you know, there's a USB standard. In order for you to be able to plug a USB thumb drive into a USB slot and have it work, it must meet the standard there.
Unfortunately, even most of those standards aren't. Like if you've ever, so for example, if you've ever looked at some of the network standards and been like, oh, you know, such and such standard is supposed to work this way, you know, I'm going to go out and see if I can write a piece of SIM content that'll detect when somebody's doing, oh, I don't know, DNS in a non-standard way. You get all kinds of flip-in. Maybe that's not a good one, but there have been several times in the past where I've looked at network standards for protocols and been like, all right, so let's go and try and find something that doesn't match with the standard. And I find so much stuff because nobody is listening to the standards. It's just, they're fault tolerant enough that it's been okay. Now, that being said, I could see where AI would be a benefit here, especially if we could allow some sharing back out, where every time a company does a you know, a mapping of fields, and that gets shared back with, say, Splunk. And then Splunk, you know, once, you know, maybe a data source comes in for 5 or 10 companies and that's shared back with Splunk, then Splunk can like update it centrally and push it back out.
Oh, yeah.
Or maybe there's some AI things where you've seen like, you know, oh, you know, we've seen from that, you know, lowercase SRC, uppercase S, lowercase RC, source underscore IP, like all of these seem to map to an IP address. And then like the machine learning recognizes and automatically classifies all of those as source. So I imagine there's things we can probably do there to improve that in the future. I don't think it'll be actual standardization. I think it's going to be a compensating mechanism.
Well, Splunk is kind of does this already though with their apps, right? You know, that are sometimes built by the companies who are producing the logs.
Yeah, but someone's got to go out and make that effort. I want to see some way via AI or machine learning or some way via crowdsourcing to do it for you, where only the first couple people have to make the effort.
Right. It'd almost be nice. I mean, this is going to sound kind of bad, but kind of nice that if Splunk were to get such a large market share that they could dictate logging standards to products and say that, you know, you are going to produce logs and they're going to look like this, period. And that's the only way you're going to get them into Splunk.
You know what? Splunk wouldn't have to do it alone. What if Splunk got together with like the other big ones, whoever they were?
Yeah, the logging cartel.
Yeah, but as long as they only use their powers for good. I mean, it's like we've talked about before. The most perfect government is a benign dictator. The problem is that the features that make a dictator don't lend themselves to being benign.
Yeah, but I mean, bottom line is we'd hope for more standardization, but the likelihood is not high.
Yeah, I don't believe that. I do not believe that. I wish, but.
Yeah, but I mean, along those same lines is where he talks about, you know, the reliance on ML is going to be higher. And we'll get into that a little bit more in a second.
Yeah.
But he brings up continuous chaos engineering, chaos campaigns.
Chaos ops.
Which is really kind of what's already, kind of was started with.
Put it right.
Maybe a misunderstanding with Netflix and chaos.
Oh, Netflix. Yeah, I think what he's saying though is like, I think what he's saying is this will become ubiquitous, is this is going to spread out across all the environments. It started with, you know, a tech company, and it's going to become a thing everywhere.
Yes, everybody will be doing it.
Yep.
And maybe I'm skeptical because it's scary. You know, Chaos Monkey was created, man, it's got to be 15 years ago, maybe. And how many companies even leverage it? So I think one of the things that, you know, concepts like this don't consider organizational inertia or lack thereof to change and introducing additional risks, which they may or may not feel are necessary. But if you were able to do this kind of thing, I think the best way to do it would be to have, and this is one of the things where why automation would be great, is because you could actually have a lab environment that mirrored production environment, and you could run all the chaos you wanted in the lab. And then whenever it identified an issue, it could then also automate the remediation, test the remediation, and then publish the remediation to production without worrying about, well, I guess with a reduced possibility that change is going to impact production.
Yeah, I don't know. I would love for automated stuff to be pushed out, because this could be done with patching as well, where it would automatically test patches and then push those out. That would be amazing, but people don't trust that now. Although maybe that's the change he's predicting, is that people will start trusting it, because the technology, like you're saying, the technology exists today.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how much IT fears automation.
Yeah.
And that may be, part of that fear may be based in job security. You know, they don't want to get rid of they want to automate away their jobs. But if you are, you know, if you transition from, you know, making the widget to designing the widget, you know, you go from doing the thing to building the automation that does it, then you're just transitioning your function to something else that's more useful and scales better. And I think if organizations do this properly, what they don't do is reduce headcount but they reduce the amount of headcount that they add because they achieve additional economies of scale with the automation. So, you know, you were going to hire three engineers, but now you don't need to hire three engineers. You need to educate one engineer. So they simply don't hire the three and maintain the existing headcount, but still get the increase in productivity. So I think if IT folks looked at it more in that light to say that, okay, my job is not going away. My job is secure. They're just not going to hire the next guy. And we're going to make this automated. I think that would, that was the way that IT workers were considering this, it might be better off. You know, it might go faster or better that way.
Yeah. And I feel like a lot of times for the automation too, very rarely will IT pony up for like a real programmer, usually just push other people into it. So I got a chance to recently work with a professional automator on a project, and it is like night and day compared to the automations that I was doing. It is like night and day in terms of like error checking and validation and just all the other stuff. And I think I kind of understand a lot of their hesitancy when you've got an amateur doing it versus somebody who has, but then again, you've got to get the experience somehow as well, right?
Yeah. Well, you also have to be willing to train people on that transition.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I think we've talked about this before and the challenges we run into with different companies with, you know, individual in particular that said, you know, on the job training is 70%.
Yeah, that's such a bullshit thing.
Well, on the job was 70%, 10% was something else, I forget, or 20% was something else, and then 10% was training.
So it was like, 70% on the job, 20% was like mentoring.
Yeah, and then 10% was training. And that was the excuse for this individual to say, well, you're not going to get training, is really what he was saying.
Yeah.
But the thing is, where training comes in value is when you do these transitions, right? When you want to transition from a dozen people swinging sickles in a wheat field to running a combine, you got to train them on the combine instead of saying that, oh, well, we're just not going to give you that training, but we're going to try to make this transition and make it successful anyway. It's just, it's fanciful thinking, actually. So what they should do is say, we're going to make this transition to automation. And we're actually going to train you to do this instead of saying, we're going to do this. And then you got to figure it out because that 70% on the job, you know, that's when you spend that 10% is when you're doing these transitions.
Yeah. And then that's how we end up with those amateurs. If you're figuring out how to do something 70% by figuring it out on the job, then you're going to end up with a lot of inefficient ways that people just puzzled out themselves.
Right. You know, I think if you tie all this automation with the historical and business efforts, then that could be even better economies of scale with this as well. And I think, you know, along the lines with automation, I think when you're talking about security tools, then it may be evaluations of security tools may be almost entirely based around the API for that security tool. You don't even look at the GUI or anything like that. You're looking at the API and how it integrates with other tools, which also means that there's going to be a bigger need for API engineers or to transition the security team into API focused.
I have two follow-ups on that. First of all, again, this goes again where I was mentioning earlier about, I think that computer science is the better starting degree for security going forward versus IT. And the second thing is people have been talking about the single pane of glass for years, right? Years and years and years. Well, we might be on the cusp of actually getting there. That makes a lot more sense on the API. I can't tell you how many tools I've looked at in the last year where the API does not provide the same amount of information as you can find in the GUI.
Yeah.
And how utterly and completely incomprehensible that is to me.
Well, that's actually one of the requirements. So I've developed a requirements checklist for security tools on the engineering side. And one of the absolute must-have requirements on the list is that you have a full API. And when I say a full API, the way I define a full API is an API, which there's nothing you can do in the GUI, which cannot be done via the API. If you don't do that, then you have a partial API.
Yeah, that makes sense. And a lot of them will say that, but I guess my interest is actually kind of on the opposite side. Rather than looking at performing actions in it, I'm looking at the information we're pulling back from it. And a lot of times the GUI will have visualizations that are difficult to send via API. And I don't know quite how to solve that problem yet.
Mm. Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah. In those instances, then it's always a pivot from your single pane glass into that tool then for that visualization.
Yeah, right now for sure, but certainly be.
I mean, maybe in the future, sure, there'll be some way to screen cap that or render it and then send it or something like that. I'm not sure exactly how you solve that problem, because that's part of the tool's secret sauce that they don't want to hand over.
Yeah.
All right. So the last section is careers. There won't be any. That's it. Happy night.
No. He believes that a lot of security analysts and engineers are going to become a lot more like electricians and accountants, connecting things according to spec, following generally accepted standards and procedures. They're going to come in after a sale. They're going to connect everything based on the templates that we talked about before, based on what the customer wants. And they're going to spend a lot of time watching dashboards for anomalies like network ops.
Well, I mean, that's really the only reason you should push dashboards unless you have an alerting dashboard. And this also ties into, you know, the increased standardization in machine learning, because his assumption is that there's going to be a lot more data to be analyzed as well.
Yeah, a lot more data. Well, assuming that it's all standardized.
Right. So his assumption is that most of your security team is going to be working around the machine learning, kind of like analysts work around in the SIEM today.
Yeah, which would be really interesting too, because I don't think we talked about it here, but there was a podcast I listened to where there was a Microsoft analyst who was talking about how at Microsoft now they're using Jupyter notebooks and queries written in Python to do data science instead of relying on like signature based alerts. So that seems super interesting to me, because that seems a lot more involved and a lot more high skill. And I'm sure that's going to be like the tier two analysts are going to be using the queries written by the tier three analysts. And then that's the kind of the tier three will be more of a mix of analyst and data scientist. So,
yeah. And then of course your tier ones have been gone away because those are all automated.
Yep. Yeah. Tier two will just become a de facto. They'll probably be called tier one in the future, but they'll be hopefully doing more advanced stuff than the tier one guys are now. So, I mean, they're going to have to be trained, and they're going to start off as, you know, like your junior tier ones now. I don't actually know how that's going to work, because they're still coming out of school as baby SOC analysts, knowing almost nothing. So you still have to grow them somehow.
Well, I mean, maybe they're going to be coming out of the boot tech schools with that skill.
Yeah, maybe. We have to figure out some way to upskill them up above what's been automated.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to get that out of college, though. It may end up that, you know, you can only get in security at a tier two with a master's degree in computer science where you've done research and stuff on machine learning or something like that.
Yeah, either that or transferring from, like we were talking about before, transferring from IT or transferring from something else first.
Right. Yeah, so I was thinking about, you know, it might be in the future, it might be possible that your security tools are really just going to be shells that have like a plug and play machine learning connection, maybe, where you can subscribe to a certain machine learning algorithm or swap them out, depending on what you want that tool to do or which machine learning algorithm provides you the most output. So maybe you have an antivirus tool that's just really a shell for how that tool communicates or whatever. And then you'll subscribe to a machine learning algorithm from a different company that's going to then feed into that tool in order to provide the evaluations. So you have, like, instead of a bunch of different security tools, you have a few tool providers and then a huge swath of machine learning companies that will plug in the foundation for the tools.
That's kind of interesting. I mean, because then you would be having that kind of jibes with having fewer tools in general and more tools where the monitoring is built into like your cloud account and your operating system. And then you're using like Splunk to collect it. And then you plug in the machine learning into Splunk rather than buying a new tool. You're buying a new algorithm that plugs into what you have.
Well, the thing is that And the algorithm is not just an algorithm, it's a subscription, right? So everybody wants to move to a subscription model. So as that algorithm improves, it gets constant updates. Maybe it's tweaked daily, maybe it's tweaked weekly, maybe it's tweaked based on a new threat environment or, you know, a new threat actor or something like that. So it's not just an algorithm that you build in and that's just it's just static. You have that subscription that says, okay, well, you've got the best the best ML algorithm we have today, but we're constantly increasing it, and our release cycle is weekly or biweekly or whatever, and you're going to get new updates to that constantly. Instead of signatures, you're going to get machine learning updates to your algorithm, or algorithm updates to your machine learning.
That makes sense. Yeah. Instead of the latest signatures you're downloading for Palo Alto, you're downloading the latest, you know, threat hunting algorithms.
Yep, exactly.
And because they're algorithms, they charge you twice as much.
Yeah. And if they call them AI, they charge three times.
That sounds about right.
Of course, you get down to your security executives, which we, what he supposed will be like factory
four. Yeah, this one, I wasn't 100% sure what he meant by factory form in there.
Well, since he's talking about that engineers are just going to be the guys that come in and plug stuff in, you know, I guess he'll just be the one standing there with the coffee cup, making sure you get plugged in right. I don't know.
Or maybe it's, maybe the point is about the fact that most of the jobs in security are going to be a lot more boring and a lot more like accountants and installers. So therefore, rather than trying to manage, you know, wild and crazy pen testers and such, you're it's like a more standard job with more standardized everything.
Yeah, I don't know. My idea that, you know, if this goes down according to his plan, I really think security executives will just go away. What you're going to end up with is you're going to have like a mid-level guy that's going to generate reports based on how well the stuff is within or without tolerances. And that's going to be reported up. And then it's going to get up at the top. And then the top guy is going to bitch at the engineering team to say, hey, why is your stuff out of spec? And then they're going to go fix it. So I think they're really going to end up with security guy being relegated to some kind of reporting function mid-level in the organization. Because he's going to have some level of power to ensure that he gets his reports, but not too high up to warrant a actual C-level position.
That's fair. Yeah. And I think we've definitely seen before some talk about a chief risk officer as opposed to a chief information security officer, because there are all kinds of risks. There's information security risk. There's physical security risk. There's IT risk. There's business risk. There's financial risk. And do they all need a C-level?
Right. So this guy, that chief risk officer, would be an amalgamation of that. And that's maybe that's who that's this guy is going to send his reports up to. So, you have your chief information security reporter.
Yeah.
Who's like at a director level or something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. So he made a big point in there for standardization and repeatability. And we talked before about Brent back when we talked about the Phoenix project, about how every company's got a Brent. They've always got some guy. It was Brent, right? Am I remembering that correctly? All right.
Yep.
There's always some guy that's the wizard that knows how to get everything done. And whenever stuff falls apart, you go to that guy and, you know, he fixes it for you. And information security's got a lot of Brents right now. We've got a lot of self-taught people that were driven, that were super interested in security before there were, you know, before there was a defined career path and kind of pushed their way up. And there's not going to be a lot of room for Brent. He thinks that 95% of the jobs are going to be absolutely standardized, kind of how network administrators are standardized now, or, you know, accountants, as he used. But 5% will always remain wizards. And he thinks that the wizards are going to be developers with data analysis skills.
Yeah, I think most of those wizards are probably going to be consultants. I don't think you're going to keep a wizard on staff, though.
Yeah, most places don't keep red teamers on staff. They don't keep. I talked with a company that you know the name of that I'm not going to say because I don't want to edit it out. And we asked them. We said, "Hey, you know, you guys are doing all this automation and you're doing all this like cool SOC stuff. We've been thinking about bringing a data scientist on to do, you know, cool machine learning and AI stuff." And they said, "You know what? We looked at that. We brought one on, and he didn't have enough stuff to do. So we ended up moving him off onto other stuff. Like they just weren't there yet. So, but in the future, maybe they will be, but I can see them. It would be more easy to bring them in as a consultant rather than bringing them in on full time, because they're going to be the really expensive ones.
Yeah. Maybe there'll be wizard guilds.
That's going to be literally the name of the company.
Yeah. But these guys are probably going to be your machine learning experts. And I imagine because, you know, we talked about the social engineering, the business email compromise stuff. I think you have your machine learning guys. You're going to have your dark web guys who are experts at infiltrating the dark web and getting in, because they're kind of like prime preps, I would say, would be somebody with, that I would call like a dark web infiltrator that can get in there and knows how to talk the lingo and get the information out of there from the folks on that. And then you have your social engineering and your insider threat experts, which are possible you might be able to keep one of those people on staff, because I'm sure they would have plenty to do on there. Whereas the other two would be somebody you'd hire consultants for.
Yeah. And I think that some of us are going to need to start thinking about how are we going to be those consultants and how do we maintain our wizardship over the next 30 years?
Potions. I was thinking about the standard love potion or the small love potion.
Oh, the smooth love potion. So I found out that article was wrong. It's actually called the smooth love potion. I was like, damn it. Now I sound like an idiot for anybody that actually knows what they're talking about. They're like, this guy's dumb.
Oh, you think we have a lot of Axie listeners?
I mean, maybe. All right. So overall takeaways. Big one is standardization, standardization, standardization. And the second one is fewer people needed due to that standardization and due to AI, machine learning, and overall automation. Then the people who are going to be working on developing the products are going to be increasingly elite work for the best programmers, which will not be me, sadly. And finally, security companies are going to be incubators for people and features that will be purchased and included into larger products. Although honestly, that's kind of going on right now. So I don't know that that's, I mean, we saw what did Mandiant buy that breach and attack simulator Veridin company and integrated it, Veridin. I mean, we see that now where stuff that is a feature. The big one that's going on right now is the asset reconciliation. That is not a product. That is a feature, and that's going to be purchased by, I don't remember the companies, there's like three of them, Panacea and Brink and Exonius. They're going to be purchased by The Sims, and they're going to be rolled into The Sims as a feature of The Sims.
Yeah, so I mean, for this one, really, what you're talking about is this is going to continue and get better with time.
Well, I guess the question here is, are then those security companies that are being purchased in the, I guess actually what he's saying here though, is right now these incubators are being purchased by larger security companies, but in the future they'll be purchased by like Microsoft and AWS rather than by larger security companies.
Right.
Yeah. I'd forgotten, you know, this has been so long. I forgot where we started.
Well, that's why it's a two-parter. Thanks for listening to the Secure Serengeti Podcast. Follow us on Twitter @SerengetiSec and download and listen to us on your favorite podcast app.